I want to bounce off of that, but Graham's had his hand up for a while. Yes, sir?
Oh, I just want to say quickly, I think a very big deal is that the 20th century is over.
Yeah.
And the bookcase of the 20th century is now a bookcase, and we can go in, and young people are very excited about the 20th century. Whereas as recently as 20 years ago, people were scared of the 20th century, scared of contemporary music. And I think the passage of the age is incredible. It's, everything's different now. It's history.
Yeah.
An artificial number.
15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Postmodern.
Now, I think it's all wide open. I also think when you publish a book, it has to be of interest to as wide a readership as possible. I think scholarly presses are very, very concerned about appealing to more than. So if you do a book on any band, they want to make sure that it's of interest to other people too, don't they?
Let me pick up on one thing that Graham said, but it's worth pointing out. Beatles, you know, academic work goes all the way back to, what, 1869 is when Wilford Brimley did Twilight of the Gods. So that's one very interesting sort of theme that runs through all of this, which is there is a tremendous difficulty with who's your audience. And I just shamelessly split the difference. The very first, I have a long, long introduction to all graceful instruments. And the first half of it is for the Academy, and the second half of it is for deadheads. And it's just totally schizophrenic, and I didn't care. There was no way to straddle that. That is going to be an ongoing problem going into the future. I don't have any speculation or thoughts as to how that gets resolved, except there is this one thought, which is, by extension, that my earlier point about why I think that we need to start moving away from interdisciplinary anthologies that are at least sort of broad-based as all graceful instruments. I would also say that within the monographic work, within articles, we need to move away from great big sweeping generalizations to much more focused microcosmic work. All of my gripes and reservations, the reason why the academic bibliography on the Grateful Dead, which is in Dead Letters Volume 3, the reason why that's a checklist is because doing the full annotated version of it would mean that I would have to start beating up on folks whose work I like, I encourage, and I would certainly have, before they went to press, you know, fussed at them and said, no, you don't have your facts right here, you know, dot, 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 dot. And again, it's not fair to beat up on them because Long Strange Trip was not out yet, so there was no factually reliable, you know, source of at least getting the right dates and the right things in place. You know, you still have people reading Scully and Dalton and saying, oh boy, Mickey Hart was on the Europe 72 tour. Yeah. So, but that's the last thing is, you know, wonderful efforts like Brent Wood's Oral Poetics of Robert Hunter are broad-based. What we need now is song-by-song analysis, that kind of microcosm.
I mean, if I can just make one quick comment, is that, I mean, we really have been talking about books, but, I mean, you know, that's in this room, articles really do, I mean, they're the coin of the realm, really. I mean, that is what really is. That's, I mean, if you look at Beth Carroll, you know, who has, maybe that's one place we ought to start focusing our energy, is to get into not just Dead Letters, but start infiltrating, you know, the other academic journals. I really focus on it to drive it into mainstream in a certain sense.
Julie first, then Kay.
I was wondering what about electronic publishing. Has this been discussed in your group at all as to the benefits of Lulu, for example, Lulu.com?
Yeah. Book search.
Have you talked about that? Because it's a very natural place for this community, I would think, especially with the word of mouth and the wild.
So segues right into what I was going to ask, which is, you know, when does it become worthwhile? Since if we're talking about what we are going to do as a group, we are a group in which there are career academics and non-career scholars. So the academics obviously feel much more pressure to have their work published by university presses, to have that imprimatur. I don't feel that pressure. I'm happy to put stuff on the internet or give it to people or whatever. I don't have the same needs and goals that people who are making a career out of academia have. So is it worthwhile to discuss something like Lulu or printlocal.com? Is it worthwhile to discuss expanding Dead Letters Press and putting stuff out there with the imprimatur of this group on it? I wonder if we're in a transition period now that there's a lot more content coming up, but the routes of transmission are not satisfactory, and we don't necessarily have the influence to make them more satisfactory. That might take longer than we want. there's a definitely a tradition in university presses. I mean, I worked in one for 8 years of buying copyrights of books that they think will sell, even if the books have been out for a while. If they think that they've been marketed to a different readership than they can reach. Now, as deadheads, we know we can reach our own readership instantaneously, and there's a lot through websites, and Dead Letters Press had a website, through the connections that we all have. So I'm wondering if the linear approach to legitimizing the publications in a traditional way through university presses is really going to work for us in, say, the next 5 or 6 years. Maybe we need people, the young scholars in here, to start getting tenure and really have more of a critical mass in 8 or 9 or 10 years than the university presses will be asking for this kind of thing. But what do we do in the interim?
Okay. That's my question. Let me just say something, which is that I think it's not clear where open source publishing is going to go. And I don't want to speculate about that, because that's just happening now. Right now, if I were an untenured assistant professor, I probably wouldn't wait until I was tenured to do this kind of research. I don't think that's necessary anymore. Mm-hmm. But I would be publishing it in very standard outlets. No offense to Nick.
No.
But Nick knows. I mean, yeah. I know we've discussed this, so I'm not stepping on his toes. Dead Letters is good to have a conversation in this group.
Yeah.
But it would be much better, you know, Natalie and I have both published in other scholarly places, and I mean, so what you're saying about infiltrating, it's begun, but that's really, first you have to establish the credibility. My fear is that if we published only, if we did in-house publishing now, we'd be ghettoizing it. So, I mean, that's just my opinion.
I defer your wisdom because I don't have the same status that you offer.
Junior people need to be published in well-established outlets, and although open source publishing, I think, is the wave of the future, very possibly, it's still too risky.
The referee.
For someone.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's unrefereed, and that's what you're looking for.
Yeah. Right. Well, refereed, but I think any open source thing is still going to be suspicious, because the people making the decision are people, you know, my age, okay? And not all of them are up to date on... Okay.
First Eric, and then Bob. First, he's at us here. First Eric, then Bob. Eric?
Thanks, Nick. I have a few things to say. I'll try to keep them short, but just an immediate response to Rebecca. How do you reconcile the advice you just gave with the advice you gave me on our listserv a couple of years ago? You know, don't publish about the Grateful Dead and put it on your CV. If you're untenured or looking for a job, that even if you get something in a peer-reviewed journal, there's still the stigma about the fact that it's the Grateful Dead. That still hasn't
Well, that,
away,
that's
right?
the, that is the advice that I used to give people, and that's actually in my book. And I still think that for the cautious person, that still is good advice. But there are places in the academy now where it is safe to publish on the topic. I mean, I think people just have to assess their own situation. It would now be totally safe within sociology, I think.
Yeah, and it's, I would say it's safe in ethnomusicology.
In ethnomusicology.
It hasn't hindered my advancement.
Yeah, when I told you that, things weren't quite there yet.
I think it also depends upon who you're applying to. I know if it came to us, we'd look at it and think, oh, cool, this guy seems interesting. Especially if it's balanced with other vanilla research.
Well, I mean, you know, what about for a high school teacher, which is
that
where
I am,
and I don't, you know, and it's that's a very different world. So.
Yeah.
Let me just say one more thing about that. I think that there's another more general principle about getting tenure, and this is where you have to balance, this is what you have to think about if you're, I mean, not in a high school setting necessarily, but in a college setting. When you're not at a research one, okay, what they used to call research one.
Still.
When you're not at a school where you've got so much time for research, you can follow several paths. When you're at a place like I'm at, and most of us are at, you need to be selective about your publications, because you have a small amount of time to make a big impact. Mm. That's why I always say I study friendship, because everything I do can fall under that category, and I'm packaged. Okay, so if you're going to publish on the Grateful Dead before you're tenured, you have to make sure it fits into your package. If you're all over the place, in most places you're not going to get tenured. Okay, you need to have a package.
Just a few quick things. I think I've seen The Simpsons and Philosophy in the television section at Barnes & Noble. I've only seen Steve's book in the philosophy section.
Barnes
and
Noble.
I saw it in the music section in Lawrence, Kansas before I came here. So it is
Barnes and Noble puts it with philosophy, Borders puts it with music.
Yeah.
Interesting. And then talking about this, you know, the kind of more academic-y Grateful Dead books, and Rebecca even said, well, if you're going to do a silly one, yeah. But even so, whether you're talking about something that's, you know, more academically oriented, how does the fact that the books about the market is so flooded with books about the Grateful Dead, from, you know, embarrassments like The Wisdom of Jerry Garcia to things like your guys' books, to things like Dan Jackson's Grateful Dead Gear, which wouldn't be called academic, but is still very serious and was about a topic that hadn't been written about, you know, to McNally's book or whatever. How is that affecting? Let me just ask my last question, and you can answer both, and then I'll sit down. It's very interesting what you said about the different presses, Nick, and it sounds like there's a stigma, even for academic presses that don't have the word university in them. Is that, did I understand you correctly?
They're just not high.
I mean, isn't that changing? Look at the publishers that are out here. They're not just university presses, and isn't like something like Scarecrow Press an example of one that's not a university press but is more respected? And then the last question, I'm sorry, I'm taking a lot of time. When my wife's first book came out a few years ago, the University of Illinois Press, and it was an edited collection, but it was about women experimental filmmakers, which no one had ever written about, so she was lucky about that. But when they were shopping it around, their first press turned it down. I forget who that was. They ended up going with University of Illinois Press. But in between, Jean, my wife, suggested to Virginia, her co-editor, that they do State University of New York Press. And Virginia said, oh, I would never be published with them, you know? So it's like there was stigma with it, you know? And Jean's new book is with SUNY Press, and she's quite happy with it, you know? So, but where did that attitude come from? How does it all fit in? Those sorts of questions.
Why don't I take the middle question? The middle question is simply, number one, it really depends on which field you're talking about. Number two, it depends on which era of which university press you're talking about. You should know that when I was pitching all of this, I mean, I was not a novice with this. So I did my homework. Every single university press I pitched, the reason I pitched it to them, as I said, you have published the following titles. This fits in with the following titles in the following ways. This is a good fit for you in the following things. It's going to have, you know, yada, yada, yada. Did all of my homework like that. You know, which opens the door for them to come back and say, number one, you know, the acquisitions editor who hired this particular title is long gone, and, you know, the title that you cite is, you know, the one of the reasons why, you know, that editor is long gone. You know, it's, you know, they've, so yeah, it, but it's hard to say. The other thing, all right, the last part of your question, the stigma thing, you should know, I can't generalize, and I don't think it's true for every field by any stretch of the imaginations. For hardcore American historiography, then yeah, a good university press is still very much the bellwether of whether it's taken seriously or not. And that has not changed.
Who are, there's no sales with those. You don't see university press books in bookstores. The libraries buy them, and then
it's not about sales.
It's a different refereeing process.
Yeah.
Where do you get your next job?
Yeah. Mark is, I mean, that nails it.
Yeah.
University presses have more rigorous review processes. And the books are better as a result. There's a reason that they have those rigorous review processes. And if you've gone through that and survived it, that means people perceive your book to be better. It doesn't mean that really good books don't get published by other presses, but that's the social construction, and that's how tenure decisions get made. So
Bob asked a long time ago before, so.
Right, and I just want to briefly endorse just about everything that Rebecca's just said about how complicated tenure processes are, and that everybody who is junior and is thinking about this has just really got to systematically assess their own situation. It will vary by discipline. And I sit on a college rank and tenure committee, and I know people in that committee are looking at the list of journals and saying, well, where does this rank in the list of journals? Is it refereed? What's their acceptance rate? Is this a big deal to get published here? I know that people on rank and tenure committees look at the package the way you describe it. Is this part of a, you know, an ongoing project, or is just some sort of little dilly thing? I know that in my school, if Grateful Dead were in the title, they would look askance. They could be talked out of it, but their initial reaction would be at least doubtful, if not openly negative. In the case of the people that I sit with, some of them would be openly negative, and it would be impossible to convince them because they're so, you know, beyond what they consider fads. That's just what they would dismiss it. So you need to think very carefully if you're a junior scholar about what to do with this. And, you know, I can talk more privately with anybody that wants to do this. I've done this for a long time.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, how many people here have served on P&T committees? Okay. And how many people would be willing to write letters for scholars and review their work? You know, when you go up for tenure, you give a list of people who would be good reviewers of your work. How many people would be willing to be on that list? I've done it for many people already.
Who's going to take somebody seriously with their undergrads?
No. So,
Frank.
As a younger scholar, I guess I was being trained while you guys were fighting those book wars. It's interesting that the two fields that you got had the history and social science, and until recently, were the ones most resistant to theory. I wonder if that has something to do with it. But the things I've heard over the past couple of days are the things that are hottest, the most hottest scholarship in American studies, cultural studies, working class studies, international studies. I mean, so this type of oral history, cultural history, etc. And the things that I've heard sound like they would be a little more rigor, perhaps, in the presentation would be exactly the kind of things that are considered hot in these fields. So I think what you're saying about the discipline matters a lot. I mean, history is notorious for being resistant to theory, and there's a big thing going on between cultural historians and historians. But if you're younger or if you're thinking about publishing it, think about the interdisciplinary place that would work well with working class studies, cultural studies, and American studies. And the cultural studies is a great example because some of the most famous British scholars made their career and made their bones, you know,
sure,
publishing about the punks.
Sure.
So I think that's really important. And if you're not familiar with Michael Denning's work, The Cultural Front, I would recommend that to anyone that's thinking about writing academically about this, or David Reynolds' Beneath the American Renaissance. Because you're talking about two hardcore, now famous academics, and they brought a lot of the methodology you all are using already, and maybe just doesn't have the terminology yet, they're using that methodology to kind of recreate the field. So I think you guys are doing the hot methodology already in a lot of ways, and sometimes just finding the right terminology for it.
Although, let me riff off of one thing that you said, because that's a great thing, and I couldn't actually quite wedge it into my earlier exegesis, which is that one of the interesting things, I mean, the reason why American history in particular has been slightly more resistant to theory than I think the Brits, although that's difficult once you really get into it, is archival research is still very much the gold standard. Archival research with the 60s, witness my earlier anecdote about my dissertation director who was at Cambridge, although he wasn't American, you know, that was his response. We are still facing a catastrophic and critical problem with archives for studying the 60s. And it's a relentless drumbeat in the scholarship. You know, difficulties with folks who don't realize that, you know, Chet Helms probably gave in excess of 200 hours of oral histories or interviews, you know, over the years that are fragmented and scattered. If someone actually did their homework and drew them all together, then we would have a very different picture of the whole Bill Graham versus Chet Helms wars that defined the San Francisco music scene to such an extent for so many bands, especially and including the Dead. There is, you know, one of the interesting subtexts to all of this is the degree to which doing good work going forward really is dependent on historians coming to, you know, stepping to the fore and doing their work, and they can't do it unless, I mean, the reason why my dissertation project turned into what it did, the reason why I'm an oral historian now is because, oh, I thought I had done all my documentary research and I'll go off and do a couple of interviews and those interviews will just give me that perfect polish and maybe give me a few great little quotes and it'll just be all great. And then 127 interviews later, I had a radically different dissertation topic entirely that was just, and I realized, okay, right, no libraries, no archives are collecting this stuff. Mm-hmm. You cannot discuss the diggers. You know, I had to use secondhand bookstores. That's a long digression, but you know, it's worth pointing out. We still don't have a good discography for the Grateful Dead. The academic problems in doing a good academic discography of the Grateful Dead are just voluminous. That's just a tip of the iceberg. Yes, sir?
I'd just like to say that maybe the obvious thing, and in a way it's a very conservative thing, but I see it as being radical. What really needs to be done is people need to do good work.
Yes.
And that's all you have
to
do.
Yep.
Now the question is, what is good work?
Doing your
and
homework.
And I'll tell you what I think good work is. First of all, it's good in terms of its internal resonances and meanings and anchoring in some kind of something outside of the work. But also, you want to have it resonate with people who are not interested in exactly what you're interested in. It should be functional. It should be of serving a use to other people. So if you're writing on the dead, if it's of use to people who are not deadheads or fans, that multiplies its functionality. And so it should be something that draws on a vision of your field, whatever it is, and that serves a vision of your field. And if you do that, it will find its place.
All of the best stuff does, too.
Now, I have this little story to tell about my own publishing situation with the Understanding Rock book, which came out in 97. I'm co-editor of that book. That book sold very little. But I just got my first royalty check last week because it won't stop selling. It keeps going. Because it's turned out, and of course you don't know in advance, but it's turned out to serve a purpose. It's assigned as readings in classes. Because it's a bunch of articles that deal in a kind of a miniature way with specific issues, and people, it's teachable, you know. And so it's been this trickle, and it just keeps on going. In fact, it was re-reviewed 3 years ago. Somebody wrote a review article in a theory journal saying, this book has been out for 9 years, let's talk about it. What's it like? What do we feel about this book now? I mean, it's shocking. Nobody thought that would happen. But it actually ended up serving a function. So the way you do that is by having your work resonate with models of understanding, methods of research that reach beyond your very specific interests.
It doesn't matter how narrow or broad it is. You don't want to be duplicative of things that are out there. And if it resonates, I was shocked when I got into the hippie narrative that nobody had taken a look at the literature through the period. It's not, I mean, why hadn't anybody done that? I don't know. That's not a very highly narrow topic, and you know, I brought literature to it and my anthropology. It was interesting letting the authors tell the story.
322.
Eric first, and you second.
Well, that just gets back to the point I asked before, and I guess I would like to revisit that question. I asked so many, I think it got kind of passed over, and that is with the how big a factor is the flooding of the market on Grateful Dead books? Because on the one hand, I think it's safe to say they're like tons of deadheads who will buy anything, doesn't matter what it's about, how good it is, you know, we will buy it. On the other hand, there are a million Grateful Dead books out. There's probably more about Bob Dylan or the Beatles, but the Dead have to be way up there as far as sheer volume of books. How is that a factor, and how does it fit in?
It's not a factor at all, and in fact, I think within the Academy, the more the merrier. At this stage, you know, Faulkner Studies is an industry unto itself, so no. I mean, I live for the day that I don't have enough time to actually read everything that gets published in that year. Right now, that takes about a weekend. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I was just going to say, to build on what was said earlier, I mean, I'm in the process of working on my dissertation, and what I've been told is you can be as you know, narrowly focused to what's your interest, but you better not just do great work and in everything, you know, to a T is as accurate as you can be, but you better damn well be able to answer that so what question. And just to echo what was said earlier, if you can't put it in a bigger perspective, sure. I mean, yes, there's a market, and I'm not trying to come across offensive, but yes, there's a market for Grateful Dead books, but if you can say there's a reason that's important to read that is above and beyond just pleasure for reading, then you're going to get it assigned in classrooms. If you can connect it to notions of identity or, you know, nationhood, or these are just things that, I mean, I connect my work with, that's the lasting impact. Or, I mean, that's what I've been told, so I'm kind of feeling out, I think I'm on the right path, but
you're right.
I was just going to say, you're getting good advice because you're being told to package it into a broader conceptual frame. And the Deadhead, my book is also like yours. It's still selling. It actually sold more last year than any other previous year. And the reason is because it's been picked up as a pedagogical text. People finally figured out. I don't know how they figured it out, because the early reviews didn't reflect this. But somehow the word got around that I knew something about teaching and that I had written about it in this book. And it's now being used to train teachers, and it's been used in the classroom to inspire students to study things by people who don't care about the dead at all. You know, and so that's the bigger frame for that, was a pedagogical thing, and you're being advised well if you're being told that. You've got to package yourself.
But at the same time, it's worth, and then we'll then mark, but it's also worth remembering, Liz, I mean, it's water on a stone. In my context, my dissertation topic change at Cambridge was the most contentious in the history of the university, or as long as they've been keeping records, like 400 and something years. I mean, full faculty vote, 207, you know, black marbles and white marbles, the whole nine yards. And the only reason it went that far is because I made an absolute pitch, you know, after I went through my oral examination. I just said, look, I understand that you don't like this, but the bottom line is you cannot explain what happened in America following World War II without discussing the Beats and the Hippies. I win. But it's water on a stone, so I win that battle. But look how long it takes me to sell All Graceful Instruments. You've got, you know, winning a battle, being able to defend a position, and then having a broader scholarly consensus that supports that opinion are two radically different things. So, yeah. Sorry, Mark first, then Ref.
As I mentioned before in my talk, you know, I did two presentations at the beginning about Grateful Dead memory. They would never get published in any kind of psychology journal. I mean, I want to put them in dead letters. I think they're of interest to this community, but the work that I'm doing on errors is part of my larger research program on trying to figure out what's going on with errors. That has a potential to be published in psychology as part of the regular literature, and it's part of a program. Just another example of this.
Yeah, I think, Nick, that what you're talking about with in terms of the historiography and of the 60s and trying to contextualize the 60s is really an important part of contextualizing what we're doing. And I also feel like you know, that's something I'm really interested in, is looking at these origins and putting the Grateful Dead in a continuum that exists after the period. But, you know, someone said the other, maybe it was even just this morning, you know, by definition, there couldn't be a Deadhead before there was a Grateful Dead. But I think we do need to sort of look at where where it was all coming from, whether it was the Beats or what, you know, what are the other these proto-hippie movements in the 40s, you know, in California, and utopian communities in upstate New York in the 19th century, and whalers traveling around the world in the 19th century, and, you know, looking at other parts of this continuum that the Grateful Dead are a part of, and it's Americana, and that's what makes us relevant to the larger world, you know. And so that's my pitch.
All I can say is get cracking, Rev.
I'm working on it.
Sorry to ask the same question three times, but I keep clarifying it in my own mind. What I mean about the flooding of the market is I'm asking about the perspective of the publishers. Are they going to say, oh, Grateful Dead, we know there are 100,000 deadheads who will buy that, sure, we'll publish it. Or are they going to say, there are too many Grateful Dead books out there already, we're not going to look at it?
What would be the answer to the answer, man?
The gulf between popular and scholarly is so wide, and there's two separate things, apples and oranges.
But they would ask, well, tell me how many copies the last one sold. Yeah. I mean, if the last Grateful Dead publication sold a million copies, then they would definitely pick up the next one.
Well, it's funny, one. Graham, that never happened with me. The only thing they talked about was, tell me how many copies, Weiner's Perspectives, Dodd and Weiner's Bibliography, and Rebecca Adams' book. That's it.
They asked, but they did ask that question, right?
But those are all three those are scholarly books and scholarly niche publishers. The fact that Blair Jackson's book may have sold 100,000 copies, that doesn't even register a blip.
It's very complicated. My book on rock and roll, since it had musical examples, Tower Records would never carry it, Barnes and Noble would never carry it. We lost millions of copies in sales. But there are sortings out there you find unfathomable that publishers make, and they're very hard and fast, and you can't
when different publishers have different markings, the fact that he's in Borders and Barnes and Nobles, McFarland does, they sell the library. So I'm thinking for my next book, I'm not an academia, some of these questions aren't important. I'm thinking, well, do I want another book that's going to sell, you know, 1,000 copies as opposed to, you know, at least having the opportunity to get some broader exposure? And so, you know, that's a marketing perspective as opposed to a 10-year academic perspective.
But it's worth pointing out. I mean, look what Open Court did to Steve. They didn't let him actually include a bibliography. He's got, you know, the most cryptic in-text, you know, citations known to humanity. This is, you know, this really undercuts the utility of his book for guiding future scholars.
For scholarship, yeah.
So, you know.
That was intentional. I mean, the idea is, you know, they think that if a deadhead walks into Barnes & Noble, sees the book, says, cool, opens it up, and it looks scholarly, it immediately goes back on the shelf. Mm-hmm. So it was designed to appeal to a non-scholarly...
Yeah,
exactly.
McNally's doesn't either, does it?
McNally's has a full apparatus of scholarly attribution. He would be the first to say that it is not a scholarly book, but having labored many months of my life helping him on his footnotes, I can tell you, they're accurate.